To recap from what Gwyndir said in the first hour, we have the technology to solve the climate crisis, but he doesn't think it's going to happen because it's an immensely difficult deal to make. As he said, we still have to make a living, and moving in the right direction on climate will put countries at a competitive disadvantage. I suggest a thought that's echoed by our second speaker in this episode, that as long as people are in competition, then the problem will not be fixable. I further suggest that the hierarchy system, which leaves the decisions to be made by a very small number of people, is utterly flawed. I'm always suspicious of people who say, yes, we're going to solve this and that and the other by 2050, long after I'm dead. Many of these people have a track record of decisions that would suggest they are psychopaths or sociopaths. That is, they have no functioning conscience. So I have to question the integrity when they make such pronouncements. Note that Gwyndir is still talking in terms of rich and poor countries. He's still thinking in terms of money. Whilst I've got a lot of respect for his research and his integrity, I think he is just too firmly trapped within the confrontational paradigm. I think we're on the brink of a change which is just too radical for him to anticipate. So let's finish his presentation now with his remarks about geoengineering.
It's taboo among most scientists to talk about it in front of the children, you and me, because they don't trust us, and I don't actually blame them. If you knew that there were ways to hold the temperature down globally, even if the carbon dioxide's getting out of control for a while, are you sure you could trust us to keep working at getting the emissions under control while we hold the temperature down? Or will we just go with, let's hold the temperature down and let the emissions rip? So they don't like to talk about it in public, but I think we're past the time when that is an acceptable way of dealing with things. I think we're going to need this stuff. We are going to go past 450. We mustn't reap the consequences of doing that, which is enough warming to trigger the feedbacks. So give me some way to hold the temperature down. I promise I'll go on working at getting those emissions down, and we will in the end, but I need two more decades. So how would you keep the temperature down? There's two leading proposals. The first one is from a guy called Paul Crutzen. He's an atmospheric chemist. He got the Nobel Prize for his work on the ozone hole. His idea was that we emulate what volcanoes do. When big volcanoes blow, they put a huge amount of sulfur into the stratosphere. High up in the stratosphere where there's no weather, it doesn't rain out, the particles stay up there for a couple of years. And that produces a cooling effect. All those particles of sulfur reflect enough sunlight to bring down the average surface temperature of the planet. When Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines blew about 15 or 20 years ago, it did that. It punched a lot of stuff up into the stratosphere, and the whole world the next year was a half a degree Celsius cooler. That's a pretty small volcano, actually. When Krakatoa blew in the 19th century, they had the year without a summer. Crops failed everywhere. People starved. I'm not suggesting we do that, but we could control the heating by doing this. And his suggestion for how to do it, you just dose aviation fuel with a 0.5% solution of sulfur dioxide, comes out of the tailpipes of the engines as they fly through the stratosphere. Keep doing that until you've got enough up there. You can repeat the dose as necessary and hold the temperature down. It's a horrific idea. Let's pollute the stratosphere. But, you know, beggars can't be choosers. We know it doesn't have huge negative effects because volcanoes do this and we're still here. So, in a way, he's sort of covered his ass in that front. But that is something we may have to do. Happily, there is a somewhat less noxious alternative that would achieve the same goal, we think, though people need to test this stuff out, and that is the brainchild of a guy called John Latham. He's a Brit. His idea is that what we could do is build a fleet of relatively small, unmanned, wind-powered vessels, you know, like 50 meters of the waterline, big yacht size. And they would be directed by satellite, and they would sail around the ocean in little fleets of a couple of dozen or a few, you know, 50 or so, separated by a couple of kilometers. And their job is they position themselves under this layer of low-lying cloud called stratocumulus cloud that covers a lot of the oceans. Any given day, about a quarter of the ocean surface is covered by this low-level, couple of hundred meters up, stratocumulus cloud. I used to be in the Navy, and I spent a lot of time under this stuff. It's almost, it's like ground fog, except it's above your head. You know those little layers of ground fog? You can see the sky through it much of the time. But it does actually reflect about 50% of the incoming sunlight. It's a major cooling factor in the planet. So these ships sail in under it, and they spray a fine mist of seawater into the air, and the turbulence carries a lot of it up into the cloud, and you thicken the clouds up. And they reflect more sunlight, not 50%, 60%. And you've got your cooling factor. None of this is a solution. It doesn't address the problem of the acidification of the oceans. Your imbalances in the carbon in the atmosphere are getting bigger and bigger. If you don't get your emissions down in the end, you're still done for. But if you have to win some time, this is how you might do it. I think we will be doing this, maybe using both of those methods and some others yet to be suggested, within 5 to 10 years. I think we'll have to. Thanks very much.
For all the interesting points that Windeyer makes in his presentation, he does seem to me to be quite firmly within the current paradigm. That is to say that his analysis is missing a dimension. That could certainly not be said about Murray Bookchin, who 3 decades ago made this remarkable presentation in which he's linking 2 topics. It took me a while to put them together. Firstly, that people look at the natural world, and what they see is coloured by the social order in which they live. Then they see that and express that as a confirmation, as a justification of the social order. And his advice is that we be aware of that when we look at nature. The second point, another out-of-the-box one, is that modern science, far from being objective, has a huge mathematical bias, that it's stressing quantity over quality. In the last 3 decades, the amount of things which are being quantitatively studied, to which units and numbers are being applied, has obviously mushroomed. Never mind the areas of life in which money and financial calculus is being applied. By applying money, Bookchin suggests, we lose qualitative truths. As a mathematician, I do find it tricky to get out of the mathematical perspective. If you haven't already listened to episode 473 by Charles Eisenstein, I recommend that if you have trouble getting your head round what Bookchin is saying. When he talks about using your seventh sense, he's talking about something that transcends the material 6 senses. And the reductionist scientific paradigm of breaking the world down into little pieces, studying them as packets of cause and effect. He's talking about a subjective rather than an objectifying view of the world. I interpret it as an endorsement to escape the mathematical, to, if you like, trust our intuition, and his advice to go to work and to change society itself is a recommendation that we seek the truth which is within us, a truth which is denied when we follow the orders of hierarchy. His advice to respect the diversity of society, harmonize our relationships with each other, I take as an encouragement to follow my heart. His idea of a gestalt to which everyone contributes, must have seemed fairly far out at the time. How could we have a global community of interest, a community of consciousness? Well, I think we're nearly there in terms of the World Wide Web. This show, apart from being broadcast on the radio, is being downloaded by people all around the world because they're interested in this show. And the next wave of technology, the semantic web, is precisely about meaning. So it has the potential to connect different language communities together. What's the relationship between Murray Bookchin's community of meaning, Gwyn Dyer's CO2 emissions targets? Well, for one thing, it's a unity. All of humanity has always been one family. At times, it's been tricked into fighting itself. Now, we see more clearly than ever. The challenges ahead of us do not affect one country, do not affect rich or poor alone. They affect all of life. Humanity has the conscious awareness of the predicament that we now face. Are we up to the challenge of using our talents to nurture and love? Can we escape the paradigm of global competition, reductionist struggle for survival? If we approach these carbon targets as painful cuts into what is important, I don't think we can expect much. And that is how our leaders, so-called, are currently presenting them to us. I've lived in the developed and the developing world, so-called, rich and poor countries, so-called, and it seems to me that harmonizing our relationships with one another, treating the world around us the way that our heart says should be treated, holds a much better promise for happiness, fulfillment, meaning, than following the current paradigm of domination, control, getting rich. Are we up to the challenge?
The fact of the matter is that every attitude we have had toward nature has actually been an echo, and even more precisely, a reflection of the attitude we have had toward each other. And that there have been as many different views toward the natural world as there have been in society itself, in the relationship between human and human. Our attitudes are entirely a product of our own relationship to each other, our attitudes toward the natural world. But this can be traced back almost to prehistory, to tribal society itself. And we can see the evolution, not only of society, but with society and along with new and different social relationships, different attitudes toward nature. Among so-called primitive peoples, the natural world is seen almost as though it were nothing more than a food web, egalitarian, reflecting the essentially egalitarian structure of so-called primitive society itself. The Algonquins, organized in clans, saw the beaver as organized in clans, and saw other animals as organized in clans. Their image of the natural world, reflecting to the degree that their society was egalitarian, the egalitarian nature of that world, the natural world itself, stressed harmony, stressed mutual aid, saw nature not as a competing marketplace in which all organisms were engaged in a struggle for existence, but as an arena for cooperation, an arena for community. One has only to go further into the Greek world, for example, and there in the dualism of Greek society itself, in the basic split between master and slave, one witnesses again another attitude toward the natural world. But not one that comes from the natural world itself, but one that comes from Greek society. And insofar as that Greek world was split between master and slave, between man and woman, between polis and countryside, so too nature was split between the cultivated and the wild, the orderly and the chaotic. So that the Greeks projected out on the natural world their own vision of their society. In the medieval world, again, one finds the natural world organized hierarchically, just as medieval society was organized hierarchically. One finds there a king of the beasts because one lives amidst kings. And one finds lowly ants because one lives in a social world built around the labor of lowly serfs. And finally, with the emergence of the market economy, where all corporate ties are dissolved, where the guild ties are dissolved, and the clan ties are dissolved, and even the ties created by the extended family are dissolved, all into free-moving atoms who are buyers and sellers in a jungle called free enterprise, one emerges with another image of the natural world. The natural world, too, is a jungle of buyers and sellers, prey and predators. And the Darwinian description of it, particularly those who followed Darwin, Huxley, and others, with their emphasis on the survival of the fittest, on prey and predator, with their emphasis on natural selection, with their view of nature as a jungle, eat or be eaten, reflected exactly the relationships that existed in the 19th century marketplace between capitalists and between the capitalist class and the working class. Now we're moving into a new era, the era of corporate capitalism, of state capitalism, of super planning and super quantification, a quantification which already began to emerge with Galileo and with the rising bourgeoisie, with its concern for accumulation, for prices, with its laws of supply and demand, and with creating a new quantified constellation that we call nature. This is a nature, again, that lends itself to quantification on the assumption that quantification is truth, that what cannot be put into an equation, what does not lend itself to systems analysis, to rationalized planning and manipulation, numerical comprehension, is not truth, is not nature. And we are foisting the paradigm of our society on the natural world and staking out the claim again that nature itself is a type of corporation, that nature itself is in fact a kind of computer, and Howard Odum itself works through a reductionism with energy that finally turns complex ecosystems, qualitative distinctions between species and between plants and animals, into the movement of energy within a whole system, a kind of plumbing of energy, as it were, a new kind of energetics which reflects the new energetics of the corporate system as a complete ecosystem economically involved in the process of natural exploitation and also of human exploitation. The very idea that nature is object to be dominated by man stems ultimately from the very domination of human by human. And throughout history, we have been projecting our social relationships, the way we have visualized our society, onto the natural world, just as heaven was organized in the feudal system along feudal lines, and nature was organized in the feudal system along feudal lines. Just as Greek dualism made its own distinctions between wild nature and tame nature, just as so-called early human beings, primitive man, created a more egalitarian system within the natural world that reflected the egalitarian system in the social world. So everywhere along the way, we have to function self-consciously with the idea that whenever we talk about nature, we not only have created a second nature called society. But very importantly, that in that second nature called society, we have always added a social dimension onto that first nature. We have always made as its underpinnings our attitudes and our relationships as the vision that we have of the natural world. So we cannot have any social ecology today. We cannot have any biology today that is so free of social interpretation as to be a so-called science. We can state facts that are true, but above all, we must always be aware of the fact that whenever we deal with nature, we are dealing with it not from our experience with the natural world, not even from the laboratory experience of the natural world, but from our experience in our interaction with each other. And if we live in a society of domination, then our attitude toward nature is going to be a domineering attitude, an outlook premise on the supposition that nature itself is mere object of manipulation. Now we are beginning again in the so-called ecology movement, and what I would more properly call the environmentalist movement, to try to examine the natural world within the framework of the given situation, as we have it now in society. We live in a world of wars, so we impute war to nature. We live with certain values called profit, so we impute profitability to nature. We live with certain emotions that we emphasize, and we impute these to nature as such, without any cognizance of the fact that many of these concepts, which we regard as value-free, are products of our own society and products of our own relationship with each other. The most striking example in all of this is the whole population issue. And I couldn't think of perhaps a more dramatic example of how we have taken our social views and projected them upon the natural world and then permitted them to bounce off to reinforce these social views again. We have a population problem only in a certain sense to begin with. And German fascism and fascism generally saw this. As machinery began to replace labor, as labor itself became increasingly superfluous with the advance of technology in the 19th century and then going into the 20th century, the problem of how to deal with masses of unemployed who were restless, how to occupy them, how to keep them from becoming a threat to the social system, became one of the most pronounced features of fascism. One does not have to go to Ehrlich, and one does not have to go to Gerhard Hardin. Quite accurately, the previous speaker has gone back to Hitler himself, but not so much to Hitler, but to a problem that Hitler faced. From the standpoint of German fascism in the 1930s, even though population was declining, even though France was giving bonuses at that time for larger families, Europe was excessively populated. It was excessively populated with respect to the technology that one saw around. It was excessively populated when one had 14, 15, and 16% unemployed, even though at that time the birth rate was going down. And out of this, German fascism built a whole demographic system based upon racism, which involved the readjustment of population to the realities of the industrial system of the 1930s and, sinisterly enough, to realities which exist to this day. The supposition and the ideological base for all of these concepts which finally led to the gas chambers of Europe in which millions of people were destroyed, not only on the basis of ethnic reasons, but on the basis of overpopulation. The rationale for that was an image of nature and an image of the natural world and population dynamics in the natural world that was imputed to the social world because of social needs, not because of natural facts. Human beings do not multiply like fruit flies. Social conditions enter into a birth rate, just as much as they enter into a death rate. Turn women into reproductive factories, reduce them to nothing more than domestics of men, convert them into mere machines, biological devices for taking care of the male and procreating a family. And at that particular point, under certain social conditions, your birth rate may soar. Change the status of women. See them not as objects, but as subjects. View them as human beings. Give meaning to the life of a woman and even to the life of a man in a family. And the population rate begins to decline, especially if that family has material security, has concerns other than problems of old age and support, is interested not merely in raising children and being a family for the express purpose of breeding, but as a family, as part of a community, to enjoy the culture, to assimilate the knowledge of that society, and hopefully of an emancipated society. So that birth rates, unlike the case of fruit flies, birth rates in human beings are not resolvable merely to a pair reproducing and then exponentially increasing until you finally have an overcrowded planet and you have to edge into the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans or whatever oceans happen to be adjacent to your continent. Change the social conditions materially. Change the spiritual conditions, change the cultural conditions, and a birth rate will go down. The sinister aspect of a purely biological approach to human birth rate is not that we are dealing with biological facts when we discuss human beings as being fruit flies. The sinister aspect of it is that we are dealing with social facts. What would it mean if a birth rate were not diminished owing to progress in cultural conditions, owing to the emancipation of women, owing to the improvement of economic conditions? What would it mean to reduce the birth rate then? What if the birth rate had to be reduced, or an argument were cited to reduce the birth rate for ecological reasons under present social conditions? The logic of that would be totalitarianism. The logic of that would be a population bureau, as Ehrlich has essentially suggested. It would be triage. Don't think only of the lifeboat ethic. Think of the famous triage system, which the Paddocks borrowed from the army. The walking wounded, who can be kept on a side, the near dead, who should be permitted to die, and those who you should concentrate on, because if you work on them, you have a chance of rescuing them. Applied from the field hospital to demographic theory, this turns out to be one of the most sinister techniques, a social technique, not a biological fact, a social technique for dealing with population. So population is not a neutral biological fact. If you want to solve our population problem, please solve the material conditions that underpin the growth in population in India. The fact that there is general neglect, the fact that population soared during the period of the Industrial Revolution, almost 170 years ago, even when tuberculosis was pandemic, and the death rate began to soar in all the great cities of Europe, particularly of England. Yet population continued to grow, because life itself was spiritually empty, because life itself had no meaning, because the social conditions of life were impoverishing to the spirit and impoverishing materially. And it's not a recent fact. It's an old demographic theory called the theory of demographic transition, that as you improve the material conditions of a community, as you change the status of women, and this represents a new dimension, as you even change the status of children in the community and what their purpose is, then population will begin to decline, or will become stabilized, or the rate of increase will begin to decline, and finally there will be population stability. So we are not talking, when we discuss population of a natural fact alone. And to reduce population dynamics in society to population dynamics in biology is not simply an act of reductionism of the most vulgar sort, but has the most sinister implications in terms of a lifeboat ethic, in terms of a triage system, and ultimately, and let us not kid ourselves about this, in terms of the ovens and the gas chambers of German fascism. And you do not have to be a fascist to provide a stepping stone to fascism. Liberalism has provided more stepping stones to fascism in the form of state control, in the form of state interference, in the form of centralization of authority, in the form of disarming populations, in the form of creating more and more bureaucracies than anything the fascists have done until they finally came to power themselves. You can be the most well-intentioned person in the world and still create this type of stepping stone toward extreme reaction. Now let me reverse the picture. Let us say that it were magically possible to reduce the American population from 200 and odd million to about 100 million. We finally fulfilled every hope of the population bombers, if you like, or the neo-Malthusians, if you like, or the ZPG demographers, if you like. I submit to you that if you did that, you would no more diminish the ecological crisis today in the United States than if you doubled the population over what it is today. Our society is a market society. It's a society built around buyers and sellers. Its whole rationale is grow or die, despite the whole literature around limits to growth. Its most essential purpose is to produce for the sake of production, because if you do not produce, even if you don't know what you're producing, you will perish because your competitor will swallow you up. And you don't need a free market economy to do that. It happens between the best monopolies. And it happens not only between the best monopolies, but study the petroleum situation, and you'll find that it happens between the best cartels. So cut the population in half, and the whole thrust of the society will be that if you have two cars, you should have three. And if you have a color television set in every single room, you should have one in every corner. And if finally you have three or four coats, be safe, have five or six. And if you don't consume it, the so-called Department of Defense will. And if the Department of Defense doesn't consume it, it will be the broker for Israelis and Arabs, for African states and Latin American military dictatorships to consume it for you. The Mesabi range will operate full steam. The marketplace will burgeon. Prices will soar. The factories will boom, with or without people in them, even with massive unemployment. But growth will take place. The mystery in America, by the way, about the idle factories is that they've simply moved them over to Taiwan. And they moved them over to Hong Kong, where labor is cheaper. Or they moved them over to the Near East, or they moved them over, or are in the process of selling new ones to China and to Russia and what have you. But the basic fact is that that growth will take place if you brought the American population down to 50 million. And with that growth would occur the same ecological dislocations, the same ecological disequilibrium, the same pollution, the same waste that marks our economy today and marks most economies in the world today, particularly in the West. But no less so almost everywhere else in the world, to one degree or another. So what I'm getting at is that we cannot deal with population dynamics. And when I speak of population dynamics, I can talk of almost any other biological dynamic. We cannot deal with these dynamics, and we cannot form our vision of nature as though we were passively dealing with a scientific fact or scientific phenomenon. We are really projecting our views everywhere along the way. Our market economy, our patriarchal society, our class society, our whole system of hierarchy, and our whole system of domination onto the natural world. And then we go back to the natural world and mine it to reinforce the very things we've projected on it in the first place. That is the supreme irony. That is the real feedback of what is called environmentalism today and biological determinism. Let me stress a very important fact here, that we don't have to be polluters to undermine this planet. We have only to simplify it. We have only to replace soil by sand. We have only to replace vegetation by concrete. We have only to replace trees by steel buildings or reinforced concrete structures, eating up our best arable land. However thinly, we have only to spread over this planet and simplify it, breaking down complex ecosystems and reducing them to simple ecosystems, turning the organic into the inorganic to undermine the natural basis for life on this planet. We can get every gizmo, or as Robert Reines puts it, every widget you could think of, and stick it into any car you like. Put it in any smokestack you wish. And yet as we go around increasing or changing the ratio of gases in the atmosphere, turning the oceans into a barren wasteland, and without even polluting, building our structures along shores and destroying vital estuaries, forever simplifying the planet, and we will have undermined at least a natural basis for any type of social life. This simplification is no less important than the amount of pollution to which we are exposed and the amount of pollution that we are creating. A second feature which is terribly important in my eyes and which I'd like to stress is that we who come out of a quantified financial society in which numbers have never been more important, whether they be statistics or stock market reports. Stemming out of that mentality and applying that to nature and calling that science, as it were, may well find that we have lost hold of qualitative truths which cannot be reduced to statistics, which cannot be reduced to energy flow, which cannot be reduced to equations. Our existing science, far from being value-free, is not only very much a product of our own social relations as we project them upon nature, but even in its methodology, represents a very limited vision of this planet and of experience. I feel very strongly that men like Goethe and Rudolf Steiner, in spite of the current trend today toward the mathematical paradigm, are correct in stressing that there are qualitative aspects of nature, aspects which cannot be reduced to equations, aspects which cannot be quantified, that are as profoundly true, if not truer, than those which can be quantified. It is only since Galileo's time that we have suddenly put on a pair of glasses, which we call mathematics and the mathematical paradigm. We have excluded everything that we cannot see with those glasses. Not only do we have social presuppositions to our image of nature, we also have philosophical presuppositions for our methodologies. Quantitative science has not said the last word. Mathematical paradigms are not the culminating conclusion of human knowledge and of human experience. And insofar as we, coming out of a completely quantified world in which human resources are literally statistics and census tables, in which nature reduced to natural resources is quantified in so many barrels of oil, so many tons of iron. In that world, we have projected for ourselves a very limited view of nature itself as being nothing but the quantifiable. And what is not quantifiable is unreal. I submit this to be false. I submit that just as an ecosystem is not simply a flow of energy to be encompassed purely by systems analysis, valuable as many of these mathematical tools may be, I argue that there is in nature itself distinct qualitative differences between species, plants and animals, the organic and the inorganic, humans, and also even between those individuals themselves. There is nothing more revealing for anybody who has a quantitative mentality than to read Roger Williams' work, Biological Individuality. Nothing more compelling to shake your faith in what is the minimum daily requirement you are supposed to have of vitamin A, B, C, or D, or whatever, or what is regarded as the normative stomach, or the normative liver, or the exactly correct paradigmatic electrocardiogram, than to read that work and see for yourself the immense variety that exists not only between species, but within a species, within same age groups of the same ethnic background, and even the same social background. One of the most compelling things we are fighting for today is the recognition of that individuality, the recognition of that diversity, not its subsumption, not its reduction into quantities that are manageable purely on the basis of an already prejudged and a pre-accepted philosophical premise. And I would ask you here too to read Burt's Metaphysical Foundations of Science to see how science itself, which we accept as holy truth in its quantified mathematical form, actually is built around Platonist philosophy and marks a reaction to Aristotelianism and also marks a very distinct bias, namely that the world is mathematical and what is not mathematical is not of this world. So I wish to make this defense of qualitative science. I wish to invoke the rights of intuition. I wish to invoke the insights of what might be called your seventh sense, and demand that they have an authority quite equal to that, and at times even superior to that, of what would be called the purely mathematical paradigm. I've stressed that I believe this world, as one who has been deeply concerned with ecology and not just environmentalism, can well be undermined by simplifying it. The biggest problem we face right now, if there is to be any nature, mathematical or qualitative, if there is to be any biological fundament for what we call society, at least the soil that will give us food that is qualitatively superior, at least an atmosphere that is breathable, at least a flora and fauna around us that is not only aesthetically refreshing, but biologically and socially renewing, is to actually go to work on the society itself. The problem is not so much our understanding of nature as it is our understanding of each other. If there is any intrinsic good in the fact that we as conscious creatures of nature can act upon nature to diversify the environment, to enrich it, to fulfill the whole thrust of biological evolution, which has been for life to assume so many different forms that it can colonize almost every area of the planet, its very atmosphere itself and some of its hottest springs, cover the whole surface of the earth with a sheet of life, with what we call a biosphere. If there is any intrinsic good in that intent, in that goal, then we have to try in some way or other to harmonize our own relationship with each other and to respect the diversity of society itself, its potential for diversification, its potential ultimately for liberation. It means that if we are going to have a sound ecological relationship with nature, we need an ecological society. And that is what social ecology is all about. Fundamentally, it means this. Not that we accept the existing conditions and merely try to analyze them. Not that we work with a methodology that assumes that what is here must be here, and how are we going to manipulate it, use it, either make it more beneficial or less harmful. But how we are literally going to change this planet, and that means above all our society, so that we will be living in a harmonized relationship with the natural world. And fundamentally that means we have to develop a society in which we live in a harmonized relationship with each other. An ecological society ultimately is one in which domination, which has no meaning in ecology, classes, which have no meaning in ecology, go to a food web and tell me what is the kingly animal and what is the lowly animal. All of the components of the food web are interdependent. So too in society, we have to eliminate those very castes, those hierarchies, and those systems of domination as well as exploitation, which will lead to a harmonized society. And with that harmonized society, we will have developed not only the social relationships, but the spiritual and cultural equipment to project out on the natural world a harmonized relationship between humanity and nature. As long as we have domination in this society, we will try to dominate nature. As long as we have a market in this society where production exists for the sake of production, we will turn nature into natural resources and mine these natural resources and simplify nature until we make the planet uninhabitable for advanced forms of life. Until such time that we homogenize and quantify, reducing forever to a lower common denominator what things have in common, ignoring their differences, ignoring their qualitative distinctions. This whole mentality of the buyer-seller relationship, this whole mentality of a moneyed society, then too, we will deal with nature merely not only as resources, but as sources of energy, and undermine all the distinctions within the natural world. If we were to follow through what it means to produce an ecological society that would be in balance with the natural world, we would have to work with certain definite assumptions. First of all, there can be no domination if people cannot directly control the society in which they live, cannot take in a single view the conditions of their own social existence. And what I'm presenting here is no more than the Hellenic attitude that we have to think small, think on a human scale so that we can begin to comprehend all the conditions of life around us. This implies the decentralization of our cities, and it implies the decentralization of our technologies, both with a view toward making it possible for all of us to control and understand how we interact with nature through our technologies, but also that we can control these technologies directly, completely comprehend all their aspects, or as many or enough of their aspects, so that we can form a judgment about them, form an opinion about them, and have something to say about what their destiny would be. It means for us, in addition, more passive systems of technology, which can best be utilized on a decentralized basis. Solar energy, wind power, methane digesters, and with that, along with such sources of energy, organic gardens in our cities, around our cities, and breaking up our cities, not into distant and far removed homesteads or hamlets, but real communities where we can get to know each other, where in terms of population, where in terms of the very geometry of these cities, it is possible in the old Hellenic sense that you can take the community in in a single view, as Aristotle would put it in the Politics. It means also not only these new technologies, a new integration of town and country, of technology and agriculture. Small is beautiful, in Schumacher's words. I would add, small is indispensable to our survival. It would mean not only that, it would also mean the elimination of domination as a mode of human operation, as a mode of association, as a mode of interrelating with our fellow human beings. And that elimination of domination is not only a classless society, such as the Marxists would have us fight for, it means even more significantly domination within the family, the domination of the young by the old, the domination of women by men, not only the domination of man by man in the factory, in the office, in the academy, in whatever. It means not only the abolition of exploitation in its economic sense, it means the abolition of domination in its spiritual sense. And with that, we would have to go not back to the factory, we'd have to go much further than Marx would have us go, down to the very nuclear basis of society itself, the family, the commune, the community, on its most local level. It would mean creating, in a sense, ecological structures, structures in which there are no kings and there are no lowly ants, no kingly beasts, no lowly ants, no kingly lions, no lowly ants. It would mean a new regard for human individuality, a recognition of distinctions between people, of differences in potential, which are not hierarchically organized, but which in fact take on the form of a gestalt, in which everyone has to contribute or can contribute what we today would normally regard as failings to the society. One can go back, for example, to the Winter Indians. Among them, there is no such thing as a village idiot. There is no such thing as a cripple. There is no such thing as a lunatic. Amongst them, rather, each one has something to really contribute to the society, is touched in some way by some degree of uniqueness. And insofar as it doesn't upset the harmony of the society, is not ranked pyramidally as above or below, but merely as part of the group as a whole. It's an entirely different sensibility, an entirely different way of thinking. Weakness has its attributes. Strength has other attributes. Intelligence or quickness of mind may be one attribute. Wisdom may be another. Craftsmanship may be a third, but none is superior to the other. And from that point of view, the very pyramidal ranking with which we organize reality in our everyday experience dissolves into a gestalt, into a harmonious integration of many different features of individuals, so that each pools into the common fund a unique individuality called the community itself through their own uniqueness as individuals. The problem of biological determinism, of trying to reduce everything in our culture, or most things in our culture, from population to emotions, from family structure to class structure, to genetic material, to the morphological apparatus of the individual, this reductionism validates the status quo. It accepts the given and fixes it eternally in the genetic material of humanity. The essential achievement of human beings, and ultimately their essential destiny, as it were, is their ability to transcend the biological, not with a view toward dominating it, but with a view toward bringing a new input into it. And that input is consciousness. We, in a sense, have a destiny in the biological world, oddly enough. And this is perhaps the most relevant biological goal that we could aim for in our analysis of society. And that is that having come out of nature, having come out of the kinship systems of clans, having come out of the sexual division of labor, having come out of age groups, into a new type of territorialism in which people can associate with each other not on the basis of blood ties, not on the basis of sexual ties, but above all on the basis of a genuine community of interests and consciousness. This can give us a new freedom, and with that a free society that can then react upon nature, not to demolish the natural world, not to simplify the natural world, but on the contrary, to reconstruct it, to help it develop, to promote variety, to do in 10 years what it might take nature 1,000,000 years to do, to recolonize and still further colonize and variegate the world of life, placing it not in our service, indeed placing nothing in our service, neither thing nor being, but on the contrary, developing a new mutualistic relationship with each other and with the entire world of life. You cannot have biology today without remembering that you have society. You cannot reduce society to biology any more than you can reduce biology to society. Both interact with each other. Both have become dimensions of a humanized nature and hopefully, in Marx's words, a naturalized humanity. And a new balance has to be struck so that the liberation, the freedom that we can introduce into our own society can be returned to nature to enrich the natural world and thereby create an even more substantial, stable base for a pacified, a peaceful, a harmonized, natural and social world.
I don't know, good horse, what in this dark heat, that robbing the rich is for worse or for best. They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest. A cheat horse is good, and I'm friendly to strangers. I ride and you're running, makes my guns talk the best. The rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man to catch me.
Media used to make this show are available at this show's address, www.unwelcomeguests.net/512. We have a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome, or you can send me email at unwelcome@altruists.org. I'd love to hear from you. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Will Ferrell, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you have.